Welcome to Sophisticated Property Investing, a podcast brought to you by Ethical Property Partners, the experts in sophisticated property investment.
Hello, this is Pete. I am one of the content producers here at Ethical Property Partners. As well as the podcast, we have our YouTube channel. And one thing that's been working brilliantly over there are our Sophisticated Saturdays. Now, this episode includes audio from a Sophisticated Saturday show where you'll hear about a deal that Frank has recently done. In the first part, you'll get all the numbers, so if you want to take part and work out how you'd do the deal, you can grab a calculator and make some notes before listening to the second part, where Frank will tell you exactly how he structured the deal in a sophisticated way. The third and final part is exclusive to you as a podcast listener, where Frank gets grilled by an expert investor and chats about the deal in more detail. So over to Frank.
I often talk about auctions being a place where you can sell properties, but not a good place to buy properties. But there are a few caveats to that. And in this episode, I'm going to set you a challenge where I describe a property that I found at auction. I'm going to pause. I'm going to ask you to work out how you would monetize that property. And then I'm going to tell you how I've done it. So let me tell you about this property. It turned up, it was quite a close property to me. It's only a couple of miles from my house. And it turned up in auction, quite an interesting property, because it was a big schoolhouse, like an old boys' school from years and years ago. If you looked at it, it'd probably be an 8 or 12 bedroom house, something like that. So quite a big detached house, quite a lot of land behind it. In fact, it had a garden of about a third of an acre, and then it had an acre and a quarter of woodland behind that. Now, I wanted some woodland for my boys to be able to play in and light fires and go camping and stuff. And because it's quite close to my house, that was quite attractive to me. And that's what made it stand out in the auction catalogue, actually, because it had this land. So the land was available for £16,000 and the property was available for £82,000. I spoke to the auctioneer. I actually spoke to the vendor's lawyers and I said, look, would you accept £98,000 for both together? Those were the guide prices in the auction. Now, often the guide price is 10% less than the reserve price, but the vendor actually confided in their solicitor and allowed the solicitor to tell us that they would accept the guide price, which was a combined total of £98,000, 82 for the property and 16 for the land behind it. Now, you weren't getting the whole property, and this is why it's so cheap. You might be thinking, hang on a second, 82K for a big old school? No, it wasn't that. It was the big building that had been split into four flats, four one-bedroom flats. And the two ground floor flats had been sold years ago. And the two upstairs flats were currently tenanted, but it was those that were available. Now, I went through the legal pack with my lawyer. I kid you not, the leasehold that had been created or had tried to be created, I could have done a better job myself, and I'm not a conveyancer. The lawyer that had done this like 20 years ago had taken a freehold agreement, a freehold contract, and tried to just like change the words into leasehold. And so it wasn't a valid leasehold at all. In fact, what they had inadvertently created was two flying freeholds. So you had the flats below on the ground floor that owned the land beneath them. So they were freeholders. And then the flats above were flying freeholds. They just like float on these flats below them, which is a nightmare. There was no freeholder. There were just these four leaseholders. It was a nightmare. It made the top two flats unmortgageable, but it also meant there was no agreement between the four flats as to who would pay for maintenance. So if the roof leaks, the ones beneath could say, well, we're not getting wet, you fix the roof. And if there was subsidence, the one on top could say, well, subsidence doesn't bother us, you know, you have to fix that, you know, that crack in your wall doesn't affect us. Or if there was rising damp, there wouldn't be an issue for the ones above. So it's a really unworkable situation, and it made all four of the properties unmortgageable, which suppressed their values. So I wasn't in direct communication with the vendor. That always makes this hard, so it makes it really hard to do a structured purchase. But I was in touch with the lawyer, and the lawyer was quite amenable to doing a deal before auction. What you don't want to do is get into the auction room and be in competition with others. And so I offered to buy the land for £1,000. You'll notice I do this a lot because it creates unencumbered land, and that means you can do anything with it. You can title split it, you can get planning on it, you can sell it, and it makes it separate to the property that normally I will get lending on. Now, because it's unmortgageable, you might think, well, how are you going to get lending? But I had a chat with the vendor and I said, look, how can we do this? How can we do the deal? I'm going to pause now and I want you to think about how you're going to structure this. Why would you want to buy two unmortgageable flats? How would you buy them? What would you do with the woodland, if anything? And how are you going to make this a deal moving forward?
This is the Sophisticated Property Investing Podcast. To see more about our Sophisticated Saturdays, just search YouTube for Ethical Property Partners.
Hey guys, welcome back. Hopefully you came up with a solution there. Let me tell you what I did with this deal. I went to a finance investor and I said, look, I've got a great deal here for £97,000. The flats, once I've turned them into leasehold flats, are going to be far more valuable than the 50 grand each that we're paying for them now, just under 50 grand each. In fact, they're going to be worth 75, 80 grand each as soon as we've split them into leaseholds. Are you willing to lend your money? I knew he had money to invest, and I'll pay you 5% per annum. He was more than happy with that. We set that up as a 5-year agreement. So he lent that money for 5 years at 5%, and I could then relax knowing that I had 5 years to sort out the leasehold. Now, the land at the rear was great. I took my kids camping. We've had parties there, we've had bonfires. It's great for them to have somewhere where they can just play with their mates, etc. Cost £1,000, which is brilliant, and now I've got a nice piece of woodland that potentially we'll get planning permission on. I've got a planning permission application in at the moment, actually, for a 6-bedroom detached house. If we get that planning permission, it hasn't been granted yet. If we do get it, it probably raises the value of that land from £15,000-16,000 now to probably £150,000. So great little layer of icing on the cake. I'm not in a hurry because the boys are using the land, I'm using the land, we have fun over there, etc. I cut my firewood there for our log burning stove at home, etc. But the property itself, I just bought it. I've got tenants in it, already had tenants in it. That pays the interest on the 5% loan from the investor. So it was cash flow positive from day one. No money down from day one, other than the grand that I paid for the woodland. So great, makes me a couple hundred pounds a month, which is brilliant after all expenses. But what I did is I just waited for a maintenance issue to arise. And I knew one would, because it's an old house. I made sure that when I first bought it, I introduced myself to the other owners. So I went and knocked on the door and said, hi, I'm Frank, I'm the new landlord above. You know, the tenants aren't changing. I obviously introduced myself to the tenants. If you need anything, these are my contact details. Nice to meet you. By the way, how do you sort out maintenance? Well, we kind of just chat about it. Oh, okay, great. And I just waited. About 6 months later, the cast iron downpipe from the guttering came away from the house and it started leaning. And the downstairs guy, one of the downstairs guys, rents his property out, and it was where his tenant walked along the path, and it was leaning, and he was worried it was gonna fall on his tenant. Massive liability claim on him if that happened. And he said to the two of us, this downpipe needs fixing, it's, I forget what it was, £200, who's willing to pay for it? But the other downstairs tenant on the other side, it was not even on his side of the house, so that seems a bit unfair. And of course my flat's on the other side of the house, and I've got one flat on that side of the house, me owning the two at the top. So it could be, the argument could be made that all four of us pay a quarter each. The argument could be made that he pays for it entirely because it's his tenant that he's worried about, even though it's detached from my flat at the top. If I don't care about it, you know, he can pay for it all. Or you could say that, well, it's on our side of the building, his flat and my flat, so we pay half each. And so I said to him, look, I'm more than happy to pay my half. It's on our half of the building. Let's do that. So we paid £100 each and got it fixed. I said, but actually this does pose a bit of a problem for us. Can the three of us sit down and have a coffee? So we met actually in the guy that lived there, the only one that lived there in his flat. And I just had an open conversation with him, and I said, do you realize that it's suppressing the value of your property? So I've just picked these up for 49 each, or whatever it works out at, 48, 49,000 pounds each. But actually yours are worth the same at the moment because we've got this problem with the leasehold. If we just went to a local lawyer and got the leasehold sorted out, with all four of us having a 999-year lease on the property and all four of us jointly owning the freehold for the building, it would instantly add value to our properties. Probably 50% increase in the value, because now they're mortgageable, so more people can buy them. Also, at the same time, we can write in a maintenance agreement, which will generally, what one would say is, all four of the flats are equally liable for all external maintenance. And so if there's a problem with the roof, all four of us pay for it. If there's subsidence, all four of us pay for it, regardless of where it is in the property, etc. Really common sense. And they saw the value in that. They said, how much would it cost? I'd already got a quote. It was just over £3,000. So I said, it's going to cost about £700-800 each for each flat. Obviously, they owned one flat each, I owned two, so I paid double, and they went for it. They said, yeah, that'd be great. So we incorporated a company that now owns the freehold. All four of us, all four of the flats own each equal shares in the freehold. At the same time, I split the title to give myself access, vehicular access to the woodland at the back, because I want to apply for planning permission later on. And we also divided the parking spaces. There are eight parking spaces in the back, so we made each of those link to one flat. So it just tidied it all up, because before then, my flats owned the whole car park, but they had use of the car park. So I used that as a bit of a bargaining tool. I said, look, if we do this, we can tidy these car parking spaces up and make it really clear that, you know, these two are for this flat, these two are for this flat, etc. And they loved it. So we paid our money each, we split the leasehold, and now instantly, I've got two properties that not only are worth 75,000 rather than 47,748, but they're now mortgageable. So I've been able to refinance both of them, take that money, pay off the finance investor and use his funds on another deal. And this, having finance available, people who are willing to lend you money on a secured or unsecured basis, is so valuable. I've done videos about this, but I'll do some more videos about that for you, about how to find these people, how to, in fact, if you'd like that, drop a note in the comments and I'll do some videos on how to find finance investors, how to borrow from them, how to have them wanting to lend more, how to have them referring you to their friends and family, etc. But basically, those funds were then freed up to no money down deal. In fact, I got cash back when I refinanced. It did take me a while. It took me probably 12 to 18 months in total, but it didn't matter, because I didn't have any of my own money in the deal anyway. So it doesn't matter. And I had 5 years on the loan. So when I offered to pay the guy back after 18 months, he was like, oh, I don't know what to do. And I said, don't worry, I'll just reborrow your funds straight away. And what I did is, when the money went back to him, I carried on paying his interest until I used the funds again a month or two later. And he loved that, because it meant that he got his continuous 5 years of interest payments. Guys, if you've enjoyed this episode, if that's opened your eyes to what's possible in terms of no money down investing. People say no money down investing is impossible. That's rubbish, absolute rubbish. We do no money down deals all the time. That's an example of it. You can borrow the money from the vendor, you can borrow the money from someone else, you can do a deal that doesn't require any money at all. This was a good example of that. Hi there, ladies and gents, and welcome to another episode of our Sophisticated Property Investing Podcast. This is a Sophisticated Saturday podcast whereby I have just described a deal to you, and now Liz Strama, EPP Partner Extraordinaire, is going to quiz me with the questions that you guys are asking, the questions that you guys might be thinking to yourselves about this particular deal. So with no further ado, over to you, Liz.
What an intro. So you mentioned at the start of this one that you normally advise auctions are a great place to sell, but not to buy. So just expand on that a bit, if you wouldn't mind. Why wouldn't you want to buy at an auction?
Because you can't get a competitive advantage. So everyone's playing on a level playing field, which sounds great if you're a novice, but you want to stack the deck in your favor when you're an experienced investor. And at an auction, you can't have any contact with the seller. Typically, we have managed it in the past, but typically the vendor is insulated from you by the auctioneer. You don't have any additional access to documentation, any ability to negotiate separately. We have done deals whereby we've negotiated on regulated tenancies with the tenant directly, but normally you're just in a room and there can be 2 or 20 and anything in between people who have identical information to you or very, very similar. And therefore, you have very little ability to structure a sophisticated deal. For example, vendor finance is impossible in an auction. You know, I'll bid 200K, but only if the vendor lends me 200K to buy it. I think you'd get the whole room laughing at you. But yet, when you're sat in front of the vendor with a cup of tea in front of you, that's exactly the kind of conversation we have. So yeah, it's just not a great place to get good deals, because there are too many people who are happy to invest traditionally, and auctions attract them. And so, you know, if a vendor's got three options, they can sell for 180 grand to a cash buyer, 180 grand to someone who needs a mortgage, or 180 grand to us, where they don't get a penny now and they get paid very slowly over the next 15 years. I'm laughing because it seems ridiculous, but that's exactly what we negotiate on some of our deals. They're going to go with number one. At a push, they'll go with number two if they don't like something about number one. But number three, they're probably more likely to relist it in auction. Like, it doesn't even register because they've already had the auctioneer say, yeah, we'll get you 180 for this. And they've already said, you know, had, oh, we've had lots of interest. We've had 50 people come and view it, you know. So for all of those reasons, it's not a great place to buy property. It's a brilliant place to sell because you use all of that to your advantage. But yeah, from a purchasing perspective, I don't think, I can think of one example. There may be more, but I can only think of one example where I bought in an auction. And it's because I spoke to the auctioneer in advance and he said, we've had zero interest. No one's going to bid. And so just keep bidding until you hit the reserve. And he said, it's a very low reserve. I was like, okay then. And lo and behold, I got an 80 grand flat for £32,000. So it was valued at 80K. And so, yeah, so there are examples of that. But again, it was probably because I had a good relationship with the auctioneer and was very lucky that the flat, well, it's not lucky, you create your own luck, don't you? But the flat was in one part of the country and the auction was a long, long way away in a cheap part of the country as well. So if that flat had gone into a London auction, it probably would have sold for a lot more. But I can't remember exactly where it was. It was something in like somewhere north. It was in Lancaster or something, but that was a 3-hour drive from the actual property. And so who's going to go and do a 6-hour round trip for an 80 grand flat, you know? So I just got lucky, or, you know, created my own luck on that one. But I can't think of a single example of buying a deal like that. And I've been to a lot of auctions. More often than not, I walk in and I'm happy to spend X and it goes for X plus 30% or X plus 50%. And I think, oh my goodness, what a waste of my time that was. I've stopped going to auctions now, unless I'm selling something. I really enjoy going to an auction when I'm selling something because I see all these people competing to pay more than one another for my deal, which I love. So yeah, in a nutshell, great to sell, not so great to buy. And most people would think it's the other way around.
And with this one, you must have noticed it because it was a local auction to you, the property's local to you. But how did you go about starting that conversation with the vendor solicitor to buy the property before the auction? And was that solicitor open to having a conversation? How did that actually come about?
So it's an interesting one. Normally that negotiation would be with the auctioneer. But so I'll tell you what the normal situation is and then I'll tell you what happened with this particular deal. But normally the auctioneer is open to a sale before auction because they want their commission. And so if they can get a definite sale before, then great. They're not that fussed about the sale price, if I'm honest. They're more interested in their headline, X percentage of properties sold. So if they can get 5, 10% sold prior to auction, then that's brilliant. The vendor may or may not be open to selling at before auction, but it's always worth asking. And so I went to my solicitor who was at the time, I have several solicitors, several conveyancing companies that work for me or that I give my work to. And one of them was a local firm in my hometown, really old fashioned conveyancing practice, actually general solicitor, but he was a conveyancer, one of the partners. And I said, look, I've got a deal and I'm really interested in it. This is what I want to do. Quite short time frames. It's actually an auction. And he said, yeah, I can represent you on that. He said, oh, just a second. What is it? And I said, oh, it's these two flats and a piece of land. And he said, oh, Frank, it's not. And he named the property. And I said, yeah, how do you know? And he said, I'm representing the vendor. And so I was like, oh, he said, I can't represent you on it. You know, I can't represent both sides. And I said, oh, how unfortunate. I said, actually, though, that could actually work out quite well. Let me pop down and see. Can I pop down and see you? He said, yeah, but I can't disclose anything about it. I said, no, that's fine. Let me just pop down for a coffee. So I popped down. Literally, his office is a 5-minute walk from my office. So I popped down and had a coffee with him. I said, look, you know the vendor. You don't have to disclose anything at all. But do you think they'd be open to a sale before purchase? And he said, yeah, I'm sure they would. And I said, well, let's have a conversation with them now. So I said, do you want to give them a bell and just ask them what their bottom line is? How much are they looking at? Because it may be that we could just get it wrapped up here and now. And he said, okay. So he gave them a call. And funnily enough, they had guided it at the reserve, which is all the vendor wanted. And so, which is unusual because normally they guide it 10% lower than the reserve. And so I was happy to pay about 10% more than they'd guided it at. But actually on the phone, the vendor said, yeah, if he can give me X amount for it, he can have it now. And so I said, I will. And it was as simple as that. I said, yeah, I'm good with that. Let's go. I said, my only condition is I want the land for a grand and then we'll put the rest on the flat. So it was, they wanted 98 in total. So I took a grand for the flat, a grand for the land, which I paid cash for, and then 97 for the two flats. And they were delighted with that. And I was delighted with that. We exchanged contracts under auction conditions, like a day or two later, about a week before the auction, something like that. And it worked very smoothly. I obviously had to instruct my own solicitors because he was representing the vendor, but just having that in that direct line of communication to the vendor. And he didn't do anything wrong. He didn't, you know, do me any favors. He wasn't obstructive either, you know, quite open, but he was serving his vendor. He was serving his client. And because of that direct line of communication, we did the deal in about 10 minutes over the phone. It was very easy, actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
If only they were all that simple.
You know, the funny thing, Liz, I think they are. The vast majority are, but the professionals who should be helping don't too often. So I find estate agents, I find letting agents, I find the solicitors, I find, not all obviously, the architects, the structural engineers, I find often, and this is why we place so much value on our power team, the vast majority are rubbish, absolutely dire. Now the ones we work with are exceptional compared to the average. And it really does make a massive difference, you know. I have all my power team's mobile numbers. I can just get hold of them. Like, for example, Liz, we had an issue just now on the podcast and I was trying to sort out why my backup recording wasn't recording. So if the primary recording fails on this, we'll be redoing this episode. But my first reaction was, oh, let me just get the sound technician on the phone. And so I've dialed Pete up, and because I've got his mobile number, I know he'll prioritize my call, etc. It's exactly the same for my accountant. I've got actually a very important question to ask my accountant later today, quite time sensitive. I'll call him on the way to school, picking the kids up from school. That'll give me a 15-minute window. I'm highly confident he'll pick up. If he doesn't, he'll call me back this evening, even if it's after hours. That's what you need from your power team. And people sometimes say, yeah, but you know, I can't get that level of service. Well, how much do you pay your power team a year? If you're paying them 500 quid a year or a grand a year, you're not going to get that because they're going to have another 100, 200 clients like you. But if you're paying them a lot of money a year because you're doing a lot of deals, and on EPP, we get the collective benefit of all the deals everyone's doing. You know, some of our lawyers are making 100 grand a year out of us easily. My accountant probably makes 20, 30 grand a year out of us. And I'm not paying all those fees. It's a combination of people that are using them. But those people have all come from me or are connected to me, and we're all connected to one another. So if any of those people phone the accountant, for example, he's going to look after them all. He respects all our business, and we become an important collective client to them. So yeah, I think power team is massively underestimated. If you have the right power team in place, those conversations are easy to have. The power team facilitate, they step out of the way when they can see you know what you're doing and you're actually better able to do this direct. My best estate agents are ones that introduce me to the vendor and then go sit in the car, and I can then spend time with the vendor direct. That's the best way of me getting the deal over the line. And when they trust me enough and respect me enough to let me go do my job, because they're generalists. Estate agents are generalists. They've got to deal with the mortgage brokers. They've got to deal with hundreds of vendors, hundreds of prospective buyers. I'm a specialist. I've only got one or two or five deals on the go at a time. They've got maybe 50 or 100. They know that I can respond quicker to their vendor, that I can pop around with the paperwork quicker, that I will invest more in that relationship than they possibly can. And when there's that level of trust, they're happy to take a back seat and let me progress it. And so that example of me just chatting to the vendor direct through the solicitor's mobile, I didn't actually say anything to the vendor. I was speaking to the solicitor and he was repeating what I said to the vendor, is actually not unusual at all for me. But I think it probably is very unusual for the average investor.
Building relationships with Power Team is absolutely vital. So with these two flats that you were buying in this particular deal, they were both unmortgageable when you bought them. So when you buy an unmortgageable property, how do you analyse your risk and how do you know that in the future it is going to be mortgageable?
I think it boils down to you don't. That's the long and short of it. It has to be a calculated risk. So it's about mitigating the risk and minimizing it. So let's look at the numbers on this. £98,000 purchase price. So not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things. It's not like it's £1 million that's going to really hurt. I met a guy in Costa Rica, actually, in the British Embassy. I had to get a deal over the line and they needed a witness signature. And the only people in the whole of Costa Rica that can witness an English document to the satisfaction of the Law Society's guidelines is the British Embassy. I had to take a plane flight to get to the British Embassy in Costa Rica. And I sat there and it took a couple of hours because these things do. Lovely guy that ended up witnessing my signature for £25, which made me chuckle because I probably spend about twice that in Belper, Derbyshire, halfway around the world. And you sit in the British Embassy, and I've never been in the British Embassy because typically you only go there if you're in trouble, don't you? and so there's pictures of Paddington Bear and red phone boxes and picture of the Queen, obviously, and that was really nostalgic, actually.
That's brilliant.
Big red carpet. Yeah, it's lovely. But anyway, I'm sat there with this American dude, pretty wealthy, pretty successful. And we started talking about why he was there, and he was there for a divorce and needed a document to show that he was actually divorced and wasn't trying to marry more than one person. But we started talking about property investing, and he said, "Oh, I'm in property." I said, "Oh, what, where do you invest then?" Because I'd actually at that point gone off Costa Rica. I was thinking, I don't think Costa Rica is right. I think it's a too hot a market. And that's why I went there, to work out, if we could do the housing project, and we can. So we're building 10 houses out there for Stepping Stones. But B, is it a good place for me to invest some of my money? And actually, I decided against that. Not forever, but I just think it's overpriced and will probably drop quite significantly. And even if it doesn't drop quite significantly, there's not the potential for capital growth that I'd want from an emerging market. And he had bought a piece of land, quite a big piece of land, for $2 million. Big piece of oceanfront property, acres and acres. And the people before him had bought it for $200,000. And 5 years later, sold it to him for $2 million. Now, that's kind of proved my point about it being a bit late to get to the party. He had owned it for about 10 years and it hadn't gone up in value at all. And he couldn't sell it. And there was a covenant that was frustrating his ability to make any money from it. So he'd basically had £2 million tied up in this property for the best part of a decade and not made a penny. Now, that is awful. Like, I can't think of a worse, that is a really bad deal. And I said to him, "Oh, so what other property interest do you have?" Thinking he's a big player, you know, that might be 5%, 10% of his holdings. And he said, "Oh, I ploughed everything into that. I had to remortgage my house to put $2 million in." So he basically took the vast majority of his whole net worth and ploughed it into a deal that went wrong. And I felt for the guy. He was quite chirpy, he was quite pragmatic about it, but I felt for him because I thought, that is hard. You know, he wasn't a young man, he was, you know, maybe 45. And so to go from the age of 35 with $2 million liquid, and you can do a lot of good with that, you know, you can make a lot of money with $2 million in your mid-30s. I don't think I had liquid $2 million at any point, even now. And so I can make a lot of money with that. And for him to then basically freeze that for the next 10 years, that is, an opportunity cost and a half. And I digress slightly, but the reason I digress is to say, don't do this. Don't take a flyer with too much of an amount of money, you know, on too big a deal. In fact, we've been playing cash flow recently. We played it at the EPP retreat recently, Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad Poor Dad cash flow games. Brilliant game, really expensive to buy. It's like 100, 200 quid to buy, but well worth it. I've been playing it with my kids actually, and which is a challenge because there's a lot of complexity in it, but they're getting the hang of it. And it's the equivalent of going for a big deal before you're ready to do a big deal. And so for me, a 98 grand purchase is a small deal. You know, if it gets, I use that word frustrated, I mean that in the legal sense of the word, to frustrate the transaction. So if you do something, if you buy it and then can't monetize it afterwards, you know, your monetization is frustrated. What I mean by that is your money just gets frozen and you're kind of stuck in the deal. So what could go wrong? Well, you pointed it out, I might not be able to make it mortgageable. Because getting it mortgageable is dependent on other people. There's four flats in the block, of which I'm only buying two, and the two beneath me have freehold titles. So I've actually got flying freehold above their two flats. Doesn't really make a lot of difference in practice, because if they've got subsidence and their flat starts falling into the ground, I'm going to want to help, because otherwise if their flat falls into the ground, mine's not going to float in midair on its own. And similarly, if the roof starts leaking and water starts coming into my flat, unless I fix it, it's going to end up in their flat. So we're kind of intrinsically linked, but in legal terms, they own the ground on under their flat. And mine floats in midair above theirs. So we wanted it, because the lawyers had messed up the conveyance decades before. So could I fall out with them and not change the legal standing? Yeah, absolutely, I could have done. But then you think to yourself, yeah, but they're worth about 50 grand each now. The rent, they were already rented and had been for many years. They were bringing in something like, I can't remember the exact numbers, but just shy of 500 quid in total. And so 500 quid a month on a 98 grand investment is not the end of the world. Those rents were low, so I had confidence I'd be able to get those rents up. Market rent now is about a grand a month, just under maybe 900 a month. So I could raise those quite a lot. And I borrowed the 98 grand. I borrowed it at 5% interest. So if you work out the numbers on that, just bear with me while I wake my phone up. 98,000 pounds, 97 actually, because I put a grand of my own money in for the land. 97 grand times 5% is 4,850 a year, divided by 12 months is £404 a month. So even if I couldn't raise the rent at all, unlikely, even if I couldn't sort the leasehold out on them, we needed to turn them into four leasehold flats, unlikely, but even if I couldn't, it still made me 100 quid a month on tenants that have been in there for donkey's years. And so I looked and I thought, that's not the end of the world. So I did it on a private investor for 5 years. So a private finance investor took it for 5 years. So I was guaranteed £100 a month for 5 years. What's that? 60 months. So is that £6,000? So I'm guaranteed £6,000 profit on a 98 grand purchase, no money down. And well, obviously I had stamp duty and I had legals, but you know, not massive. And I reckoned I could probably still flip them in 5 years' time for a bit more than 98 grand. Plus I had the woodland in the background, in the back for free. So I thought the risk was very low. If it all went wrong, the cost to me was also very low, but the upside was quite big. So it's not close your eyes and jump. It's have a look over the edge, work out how you can protect yourself, do your best to make sure the deal works. But if it does all go wrong, it's the old adage that we use on EPP all the time, heads we win, tails we don't lose. And I reckon worst case scenario, I wouldn't lose any money. And best case scenario, I can make a really good income off this and a really good profit. So that's where I got to on it, Liz.
And the land which came with it, originally when you bought it, it was worth around about 16,000. You were saying, but it could be worth around 150,000 if planning is granted. So has there been any more progress with the planning you've put in for the 6-bedroom house? And if you do get that planning, or if you've already got it, are you going to develop that yourself, or are you going to try and sell the land with the planning on it?
Yeah, really good question. So the planning application's gone in. The public consultation has ended. We had something like five or six, they have a correct legal term, but it escapes me, but letters of support and one letter of objection, which was very weak. So over that would be classed as overwhelming public support, which is great. That consultation period is now ended, so no one can ever comment on it again, which is good. So we've won that. So the council have come and inspected the site and have confirmed that it's not at all visible from the nature reserve. So all the paths on the nature reserve, they walked up and down them, and actually the building would be hidden from every single viewpoint within the nature reserve. That was their biggest concern. So we've won that one as well. They're actually in support of it. The only thing that's holding it back is Highways have objected to the access onto the road. So that's what we're working on at the moment. We've responded to Highways and offered some suggestions for how we can improve the access. We've spoken to a neighbour about potentially buying a bit of their land, only about 2-3 square metres, in order to increase the splay. So increase the problem that Highways have is, as you pull out of the property, you can't see very well to your right or left because there's like high walls and they're almost right angles. And so if we can just increase those splays, so kind of make them diagonal walls rather than right angles, so just, you know, carve off a bit on both sides, then they'll remove their objection. But the thing is, there's already parking for 8 cars there, and we're adding parking for 2 cars, so it's not a massive increase. So I'm confident we'll win it. These things just take time, that's the only disadvantage. And with my architect, we've got about this is funny, plan A, B, C, D, and E to get planning permission. So it might take a little longer than I'd hoped, but I'm not in a hurry for it. This is free money at the end of the day. Do you know what I mean? The flats are now making a nice profit for themselves. They are mortgageable now. So the refinance is, you know, I've got all my cash out. I've paid the investor back. Well, I didn't put any cash in, but I've paid the investor back and got a bit of cash in on it. So it's a really solid investment where whatever happens from here on in is a bonus. So if we won't get planning permission this year, but likely to get planning permission next year. But even if it rolled into the year after, that's all cool. You know, it's a nice 100-150k. To answer your question about would I build it out, I actually have quite an appetite to do an eco house. I've never done one. If I'm still living here, it's about a third of a mile, half a mile, mile from my house. So if I'm still living here, I probably would really fancy project managing it myself and building it out. I think it'd be a lovely place to live. If at any point I decided to move from there, then I could let it as a holiday let really easily. It's very close to the centre of town, but feels like it's 5 miles out of town. It's about 400 yards in the centre of town, amazingly, maybe 500 yards. And yet it feels like you're about 5 miles out of town. So I would like to build it out myself. But it would depend on what else I've got on at the time, depend on what the market's doing. You know, that market's going through the roof at the moment, but unfortunately so are materials. So it might not be the right time to build it. But we'll see. We'll see. And I wouldn't mind sitting on it. You know, planning permission lasts for 3 years. All you have to do is dig the foundations and then you can build it over the next 30 years if you want. So I'm at the stage in my career where I'm deleveraging at the moment. So what that means is I'm trying to reduce my loan to value across my portfolio from a safety perspective, from a cash flow perspective, because it increases cash flow. What it does mean is that you have to become less aggressive in your purchasing because, you know, you leverage up in order to get cash, in order to buy more. But one of the best ways of deleveraging is to build without taking finance. And so if you take your time building and you fund that out of profits from your portfolio, you end up at the end of the build, albeit slightly a slower build, you end up at the end of the build with an unencumbered 6-bedroom property in a beautiful location. And of course that massively deleverages your portfolio then. So that does attract, that is appealing as well, Liz. So it does depend, but I've got options there. But one thing at a time, and the first thing is to get the planning.
That sounds like a really exciting project. It would be great if you do decide to do that. It would be great to see you kind of document how you get along with that, especially with it being an eco house. I think that's really interesting.
We'll do a YouTube episode or two for sure.
Going back to the flats, If the two ground floor flat owners didn't agree to the new freehold, and I know it wouldn't have made sense for them not to agree, but sometimes you do come across people who, you know, for whatever reason...
People are not always logical, are they?
They just don't want to do it. Yeah. So did you kind of have a plan B in your mind, or did you just think, actually, if it was left as a flying freehold for your flats, you weren't too bothered?
I wasn't too bothered. I knew I had 5 years to sort it out. You know, if it got to 4 years or something and they'd made it clear that they just didn't want anything to do with me or the sorting out of the leasehold, then I probably would have spent that year focusing on accumulating cash to pay the investor back out of my own pocket and then had that as an unencumbered property in my portfolio to again bring leverage down. That would have worked just fine. And then instead of it making me £100 a month, it would have made me £500 a month, you know. So that would have been just fine. Not great use for £100,000, but, you know, needs must. You know, if that's plan C, it's not the end of the world, is it? If you back yourself to make £100,000 in a year, you know, which I would do, I'd have to prioritize it and I'd have to look at how I was going to raise that money. But that's only 4 TDIC flips, you know, it's not a huge amount to make in a year, in addition to, you know, my normal income. I also would have spoken to the investor. In fact, I did speak to the investor because I didn't fancy refinancing at one point. And so I said to the investor, look, I'm busy. I'm doing a load of refinances. They take a lot of time. Lenders are a pain in the backside. Would you be interested in leaving your money in for any longer? And he said, like, how long? And I said, well, multiples of a year, really. Do you want to do 1 year, 3 years, 2 years? I said, it would help me out, but only if it works for you. And he'd actually recently gone through a divorce. And he said, actually, I'm just trying to sort out the finances on my divorce. And that £100,000 would really help me to do that. Do you mind if we stick to the original agreement? And because I was talking to him at the end of year four or during year three, I can't remember, it was no problem. There's no pressure. It wasn't like it was 2 months before the end of the term and I didn't have the money. And so I said, oh no, I didn't realize about the divorce. So sorry, no problem at all. We'll get your money back on the day that the agreement ends. And so we did do that. But yeah, that would have been my plan B, plan C.
I think this is a great deal. And it's an absolute classic example of your icing on the cake. Which is brilliant because the deal, even without the land or the planning or anything else, it works fine. But then once you start adding those layers of icing, it suddenly becomes really exciting. So thanks for sharing that one with us.
Can I just point something out, Liz? If I couldn't make it mortgageable, I would still have the ability to raise the rents over time and I'd still have the land with the potential of the planning, etc. So that bit could go wrong and I'd still make an absolute killing. You know, I don't have any intention of doing this, but I could sell the land for the £150,000, pay off the flats, and now I've got two flats that have not even cost me a penny. So there's a lot of ways of it working out. It's never guaranteed. No deal is guaranteed. And I think some investors sometimes, you know, sit there waiting for the perfect deal. There's never a perfect deal. There's always an element of risk. But on this particular one and on most of them, the chances of A, B, C, D, E, and F all going wrong in order for you to lose money are so remote that you may as well crack on because the likelihood is X, Y, Z, etc. are not all going to go right. But if enough of them go right, you make decent money and sometimes you get a slam dunk that makes you tons of money. But most of the time, they just trickle along and the brilliant thing with property is over time, the tide is continually rising. Yes, it goes up and down a bit, but the tide just gets better and better. And so the saying is the tide lifts all boats. And so every single property in your portfolio is just gradually getting more valuable over years and the cash flow is improving. And so, yeah, it is a good deal, Liz. And But most deals are good. If you can buy a property that cash flows positive without using any of your own money, you should buy as many of those as you can, all else being equal. And over time, that will make you incredibly wealthy. So, yeah, it's exciting.
Fantastic.
Guys, hope you enjoyed that episode. That was Liz Strama interviewing me on this sophisticated Saturday deal. If you want to hear more of these episodes, then be sure to subscribe to this podcast channel, the Sophisticated Property Investment Podcast by me, Frank Flegg, and selected guests. If you think this episode or this channel, this podcast would be of benefit to your friends, family, associates, please do share it. Be very, very grateful. You can hit the share button, whack it on WhatsApp. That would really help us to grow the podcast and add even more value to your property investment business. Until next time, guys. Happy investing.
That was the Sophisticated Property Investing Podcast from Ethical Property Partners. Use your podcast app to follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.